The Tom Woods Show, episode 1146.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, anti-gun arguments are repeated often and loudly by high-profile people, but they are easily smashed and refuted with my free ebook, Your Facebook Friends Are Wrong About Guns. Check it out at wrongaboutguns.com.
Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. I've had so much demand for an episode on what's been going on in recent days between North and South Korea, in particular, a meeting between the leaders of those two countries. And in fact, even just the acknowledgement that they are two countries is an interesting development on the part of the North. But there was issued some kind of agreement on some fundamentals as the future unfolds between these two countries, and it certainly looks like a very, very favorable outcome indeed. So I wanted to talk to Michael Malice about what's going on here. Michael, of course, is the author of the tremendous book, Dear Reader, The Unauthorized Autobiography of Kim Jong-il. That will be linked, of course, at tomwoods.com/1146. Michael is a New York Times best-selling celebrity ghostwriter. He is also, of course, an author in his own right, and this book, Dear Reader, I cannot recommend to you highly enough. You can find him on Fox News and Fox Business, particularly as a regular on Kennedy, and you can follow him at michaelmalice.com and, of course, on Twitter at Michael Malice. Michael, welcome back.
Thanks, Dr. Woods.
I had a lot of requests to get you back on because of what's going on in Korea, North and South Korea. Unbelievable news. And people say, we got to get Michael Malice on. People saying, I credit Michael Malice for this. All kinds of comments being made in my private group, which everybody listening should consider joining. You can get there through supportinglisteners.com. And I just thought, well, look, I got the bat phone. I can reach Michael Malice anytime I need to. So let's indeed talk about it. Now, first of all, before I ask you specific questions, were you surprised?
Surprised by what specifically?
Well, surprised that, well, let's see, that the meeting took place, that Kim acknowledged the existence of North and South Korea as political and not just geographical entities. I mean, just go down the list.
Well, I mean, we could go down the list. I mean, I'm not being pedantic because there's some things that are certainly far more surprising than others. I'm not surprised by the meeting at all. They've met before in the 90s when they had the Sunshine Policy from the South. This is a chapter in my book. And Kim Dae-jung, who was the South Korean president at the time, got a Nobel Peace Prize when he met with Kim Jong-un's father, the dear leader Kim Jong-il. So there's precedent for this. They've been making overtures for quite a while. So I was not surprised by that at all. I was surprised by how poignant, for lack of a better word, although that's not the correct word, the visuals were. Because just visually, you know, kind of this crossing the Rubicon kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure I'm butchering the metaphor vis-a-vis Caesar. But, you know, having them holding hands and crossing the DMZ, the demarcation line, that visually was a very big deal. And again, having Kim, and the thing that, Tom, when I was in North Korea, I was in that building he came out of. So there was an extra element of surrealness for me. And just watching them, him just like, you know, hobble out of there, you know, and meet, you know, because usually when you have dignitaries meet, I can't think of a single other example. They're meeting at the White House. They're meeting, you know, at number 10 Downing Street or in Parliament. They're meeting at some official building. They're not just walking at each other at what looks like basically a parking lot. So that in itself added a weird element to it. So, and his affect was very affable, which is not a surprise. But all that, the fact that he left North Korea, you know, the reports are saying this is the first time that a North Korean leader has left gone to South Korea since the end of the Korean War. I am 99% sure that no North Korean leader has ever stepped foot in South Korea during the Korean War at the beginning when the great leader Kim Il Sung conquered 95% of the peninsula and drove us all, you know, all the forces all the way back down to a little pocket. I don't think he was part of the fighting forces. So I think this is literally the first time this has ever happened.
Talk about the things that the two sides have now agreed to. I mean, they're going to cease propaganda against each other, military exercises directed against each other. They want to foster more and more cooperation. What are some of the precise details?
I don't think we have much precision as of yet. North Korea is phenomenal in their use of deceit and double talk. So I think there's a lot of groundwork for what we're seeing to denuclearize, to have, you know, the whole big thing about we're not going to have any more war on this peninsula. Well, that's largely the status quo. So, I mean, there are things that the South Koreans have said they're going to bring up in future meetings, including mentioning the decades-long kidnapping of Japanese citizens by the North Korean government, which Kim Jong-il acknowledged in 2001. So there's going to be a lot on the table. And Kim Jong-un also said, you know, he would go to the Blue House, which is where the South Korean president's residence is, which is just ironic because historically they've sent many assassins to the Blue House to try to kill the South Korean president at the time. So this is unfolding in an unusual way. It's not very clear what is going on behind the scenes, though, because, again, I always have to remind people in last summer, remember last summer, long ago, those days of yore, they were threatening to nuke Guam. In November, they sentenced President Trump to death. That was not that long ago. So, I mean, let's take a deep breath for a second. And not one person has been released from the concentration camps. Not one nuclear missile has been disassembled. So let's take this with a grain of salt and at the very least enjoy the symbolism before we kind of, you know, take a deep breath and realize maybe that's all there is going on here.
It was interesting the way Kim signed the guest book in South Korea, in which he was portending a new beginning in history, starting right this minute. I wonder, what do you think motivates this, especially given the fact that, you know, the two sides have been engaged in propaganda against one another and sometimes not particularly friendly rhetoric, particularly from the North.
Sure.
How do we move from that to a new era of peace is upon us?
Well, it's not only from the North. I mean, the South, you know, like there was a question, a friend of mine wanted to bring copies of my book, Dear Reader, to South Korea. And he was wondering whether it would be legal because it would be perceived in a sense as North Korean propaganda, which I guess it is because I'm, putting forth the North's version of events from their point of view. So, and in 1994, when Kim Il-sung, the great leader, died, and, you know, some of the South Korean commies wanted to celebrate or to memorialize him, rather, this was put down by the South Korean government. So they don't have the First Amendment in the sense that we do. So it goes in both directions. You know, of course, from the North, it's much worse because the North has to lie much more about how bad the South is. Well, the South can largely tell the truth, and it doesn't have to be propaganda. It's a fact of how depraved and evil, you know, North Korea is. It's the worst country on earth. So, and again, it depends on, and also I'm sure North Korea at this point has to have grudging concessions that their propaganda is not very efficacious when people have access to independent information. You know, if the South Korean government's telling you one thing and the North Korean government's telling you something else, well, you could just go to their version of Wikipedia and you don't have to listen to either government. Same thing that happens here when our government tells us one thing or the corporate press. You can do your homework online and find some semblance of the truth. So I think there's also that understanding that maybe it's propaganda ain't what it cracked up to be in the days when you could have complete control and censorship of information.
Tell me if it's too early to answer this question, but if we have both sides saying that from now on we're going to proceed on the presumption of peace and reconciliation, what would that mean for the future of the U.S. presence there?
See, this is why something's not adding up and it's bonkers. Because let's suppose Kim Jong-un said, I will take all my nukes and I will let all those areas be open to inspections by either the UN or South Korea or the US or China, whomever. And in exchange, you guys promise to get the US troops out of South Korea. Well, that would be a great deal. I think it would be wonderful for all sides that occurred. I mean, there's no reason for us to be there at this point. He's not even saying that. Before the meeting even happened, he's saying, I'm perfectly fine with you guys leaving American troops in South Korea. That doesn't make sense. I mean, so something is clearly, something's not adding up. And as Judge Judy likes to say, if it doesn't make sense, it's not true.
All right. So we have to wait a little bit longer then, maybe, to see what really is going to come of all this?
Well, obviously. You know what I mean? Like, when you're dealing with anyone who's like not acting in good faith, it's the same thing I was saying last summer. When they were going to nuke Guam and everyone's flipping out and Chuck Schumer is saying, you know, Trump's reckless rhetoric has gotten us to this place, to the brink of war, I went on TV and I said, calm down. You know, if you're going to nuke the United States, is Guam going to be that first shot you take? You know what I mean? When Japan hit Pearl Harbor, that was our fleet. It's not like they hit, you know, God forbid, you know, Seattle or something. They're not. So, and of course, nothing ended up happening. So it's the same kind of thing here. Everyone's all excited. Oh, my goodness. You know, it's the end of the North Korean regime and it's going to be kumbaya. Take a deep breath. Give it 6 months. We'll see where we are. At the very least, let's wait to see what happens when they meet with President Trump, because that is going to be something else.
Yeah. Now, let's talk about that. Now, forgive me if I'm asking, in some cases, questions that really are unanswerable at the moment, but yet I feel compelled to ask them. Is there any role, people want to know, or people are already presuming, that Donald Trump played in this? Him or his team, his foreign policy team? Is there any U.S. role? Can Trump take credit for this in any way? Not will he take the credit, but okay. Can he legitimately take the credit?
I got you. South Korea said this explicitly already today, number one. Number two is, for 8 years under Obama, North Korea was not an issue, or it was a sideshow. And part of the reason I wrote the book was to bring it to greater public consciousness. The very first thing when Trump got into office was he was talking about North Korea. He had President Xi from China visit him in Mar-a-Lago when he had the State of the Union. I got into it with Ann Coulter on Twitter because she's like, oh, why is this our problem? And he spent a huge portion of the State of the Union on North Korea. This is clearly something where he thought he can use the power of the presidency to make the world a better place. In my view, the North Korean issue is the most unambiguous foreign policy issue there is, because they're so bad. There's no if the North Korean regime vanished tomorrow peacefully, there'd be no real downside. I mean, it's not like some of these other countries like Libya, where it goes to hell and you have slave auctions the next day. That would not be this case in North Korea, because both China and Japan and South Korea would quickly have some kind of Marshall Plan to guide them towards civilization. So he clearly has been twisting the screws and generating momentum on this issue, by all accounts.
So when you look at the whole package, I mean, quite a bit happened today. What part of it surprised you, Michael Malice, the most?
I was the most surprised. Well, I don't know that I was. I predicted this, you know, a while ago, like 2 months ago. So it was surprising, you know, seeing it. What disappointed me the most was how everyone is going out of their way to be like, well, Trump shouldn't get any credit for this. And my point of view is, listen, if we're going to be at a point where concentration camps are closed down and the world's largest prison country is liberated in any capacity, there's plenty of credit to go around. I'll give credit to Obama, Pelosi, Hillary, Jill Stein, Bernie Sanders, Mitch McConnell, Paul Ryan. I don't care. Free the camps. You know what I mean? So the fact that this is people's priority, and Max Boot, you know, who is the Cretan of Cretans, he had a tweet today, something about like, you know, there's no evidence that this means the end of the Korean War, when both sides are saying this means the end of the Korean War. Now, that's not proof, but it's certainly evidence that that's the direction it's going to. So that it's really kind of gross to me, to be blunt.
Well, of all people to talk like that, Max Boot's whole foreign policy is based on claims with no evidence behind them. So
yes.
Of all people to say
right.
That. Now, I obviously don't know nearly what you do about the personal dictatorship of Kim Jong-un, because what I'm wondering is, are there...
I could recommend a great book for you.
Yeah, no kidding. But are there around him, are there hardliners like in the North Korean Communist Party who are grumbling at this point with each other, saying, what is going on here? This is a betrayal of our lofty ideals.
No, because the lofty ideal is the leader's will be done. And whenever every leader takes over, there are purges of the people at the very top. So their role is to do what the leader wants. So it's not at all like some Politburo, you know, where you have Stalin and you have everyone around him and they're kind of plotting behind him. That's not the way it is. They're there to support him. And I'll say something else. The people at the very top, you know, I can't get into how I know this stuff. The people at the very top, if anything, would be amenable to liberalizing the country because they're not dummies. They see what's happening in China. They just don't want to personally be executed, but they would certainly realize this would make them wealthier and make the country, in a sense, easier to control.
All right. What's coming up then in the relatively near future? I read that next month, apparently, the defense ministers of North and South Korea are going to be meeting. And then what else is on the table? You mentioned, of course, meeting with Trump. What's going to be on the table there?
I mean, what's ever on the table in a meeting with Trump? My hope, and I don't know that this is going to come true, is that he hits them with human rights stuff. And if there's some way for them to implement this and you know, institute some sort of bare minimum level of rights in North Korea, this would be the wonderful, you know, the greatest thing imaginable. It's much more of an issue than the nukes, which they have, you know, no intention of firing. I don't see how they're going to give them up after Syria, you know, us bombing Syria in connection with the UK and France. And I honestly think that when you hear him talk about North Korea, he's not talking about them in a neocon kind of way, like they have nukes and they're about to, you know, we better go in there or else they're going to nuke Seoul. He doesn't talk about them like that. He very much talks about them as what is wrong with these people and let's have, and this kind of backhanded, let's keep, treat Kim Jong-un with respect. And listen, if you want to kiss his butt and make him feel like a big shot and use that as a mechanism to get him to do the right and proper thing, I'm fine with that too. I mean, I don't think there's any price to pay when you're talking about 25 million slaves.
Describe for me the scenario in which these steps toward, maybe openness is not the right word, but well, to some degree it is an openness toward the South that hasn't been present before. Describe for me a scenario in which this somehow undermines the regime in the North.
Well, if you found out that George Washington was a genocidal dictator, you know, who took entire families captive and, you know, made the Whiskey Rebellion look like, you know what I mean, to the 100th degree, you would certainly have a very different perspective on voting and the federal government. So there's a book in North Korea called The U.S. Imperialists Started the Korean War. I'm sure you can guess the plot twist there. So for them to find out that Kim Il-sung, who they all consider the pretty much the greatest human being ever lived, for them to find out what a horrible person he is, well, that's the whole grounding for Kim Jong-un's claims to authority. So this is a house of cards that they've built, no pun intended. And I don't, as soon as there's a little bit of liberalization, it's going to get very, very dicey for him. And it's, I mean, it's the comparison to China. I mean, when they kind of liberalized, they took Mao off his pedestal. They still venerate him, but it's very much a change from the Maoist ways. There's an ambiguity vis-a-vis Mao. It's not that way in North Korea. So I don't know how that would work. It just seems personally very dicey for, you know, someone who's so young too.
I was describing some of the features of present-day North Korea, features I know about only because of you. And in fact, that song that you told me about, what is it, My General? What are the songs?
Where Are You, My General?
Where Are You, My General? That's played in the mornings in Pyongyang, is that
correct?
Is that right? Yeah. And so I played that for Regina, and I was telling her other features of the regime, and she just couldn't believe it. She said it just sounds like something straight out of Orwell. And what I wonder about is, what is it like to meet with the leader of that country, knowing that you're dealing with the head of a totalitarian regime that you almost couldn't parody, and he's got this big, you know, goofy grin on his face? Of course, you want to be at peace with him if you possibly can, and you'd rather see him be peaceful than bellicose. But beyond that, I think I would feel creeped out? I don't know. I think it'd be hard to have serious diplomatic conversations with somebody like this.
I think there would have to be some level of cognitive dissonance. I read this book, which was a history of the drug cocaine. And as part of it, the author went to South America and met with these two drug lords. You know, and they had a ranch and they were just these fat, you know, I think Colombian guys. And he's talking to them, very amiable. and they go, "What do you expect, horns?" You know, when you that's the whole point. My friend who went to Auschwitz, I remember where this quote was. The point they made is grass grows here. You expect these things to be on another planet. You know what I mean? Because it's so removed from our concept of decency and humanity. And then you see this just like fat guy in a suit and realize he just killed his older brother and his uncle. And he's starving children today for political purposes. It's very hard to reconcile these two things. I mean, I'm not a psychologist, but it's just mind boggling, I think, to me. It's just mind boggling when you're there, too. Like every aspect of it is just bonkers.
Have you been reading a lot of commentary about this, or have you just been reading just the straight facts?
I've been reading a little bit of the commentary. I get some of it on Twitter. A lot of it just makes me wince.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to know. What are people getting wrong about this? Leave Max Boot out of it. I mean, that poor guy's been beaten up enough on this show.
I think basically the two schools of thought I've seen are cautious optimism, premature exuberance, and, well, Trump shouldn't get credit. So I don't think people really know what to make of this. I think that is the correct approach. We're not going to know what to make of this for quite a bit of time. Like I said, they haven't freed a single person. They haven't taken down one missile. But the other thing is, I know you can put that song we mentioned earlier in the show notes page. Something I would very much encourage you to put in the show notes page as well is there have been these family reunification events where people who were separated for decades, brother and brother and things like that, between North and South, were allowed to meet. And they're running across each other and hugging and catching up after decades. And then the Northern half, you know, at the end of the day, they're spirited away and they're never heard from again by their Southern counterpart. And you watch these videos and it is very hard to keep a dry eye. I mean, you have a family. Can you imagine like one of your kids or Heather, God forbid, is taken away in the midst of war? And for 30 years, you have literally no information about them. And then out of nowhere, you get to meet them, but only for a day. This is like some kind of Faustian bargain. So when you see these videos, it really messes with your head something fierce.
Wow. Yeah, that is. Because of course, I'm thinking about my own particular circumstances and my own case.
And the other thing is, these families are separated for one reason: the dictatorship of the Kim family. There's no other reason for them not to be in contact at all.
Yeah. Now, a move like this could represent, I mean, you could see it representing either a posture of confidence on the part of the regime in the North or a posture of weakness. And so they've got to just try some kind of diplomatic gamble. Which one do you think it is?
He certainly looks confident. I mean, he is confident because, again, like if anything bad happens, it's the citizenry that are going to pay the price, not really him. So there is one of the things I'm really gratified about, I was just on Breitbart talking about this, like 10 years ago, the whole argument was that they're crazy and suicidal, right? And it's like, if they're so suicidal, they've been around now for what, 70 years? That's really bad at being suicidal. And now people are realizing far more, especially on the right, that these are evil but rational actors and are trying to look at things from North Korea's perspective. Whereas you remember during the Bush years, the idea of looking at things from, you know, another country's perspective, well, that means you agree with them. You know what I mean? It was just this very weird idea that to understand your enemy is to validate his point of view as opposed to try to outwit him. So that's something I think that has changed a bit recently. And the thing is, no one knows what he's thinking. And again, this isn't necessarily going to be the status quo ante in another 6 months.
True. So again, a lot of what we're talking about is quite tentative, but
yeah.
Everybody justifiably is paying attention to this. And I was a bit of in the premature exuberance camp just because I'm so unaccustomed to good news in the world.
I just
latched onto this one like crazy. But
well, you know what? You know why else? Is because when's the last time you heard of a war ending?
Yeah, I know.
So,
and everybody being happy and both sides, you know, smiling and that's it. No threats. So
even though it's been literally 65 years, I mean, yeah, we finally have a war that ended. So, I mean, yeah, maybe just on that, let's, you know, have a little bit moment of applause. And especially, you know, in all seriousness, for all the veterans and people who are families of veterans of the Korean War, which is, you know, referred to often as the Forgotten War, for them, this must be a great feeling of closure.
Now, what in this story have I neglected to ask you about that's important for people to know?
That's a great question. I don't know that I have a good answer. How about this? Why is this happening now? And I think one possibility is Kim Jong-un is not a product of the Cold War like the two preceding leaders are.
He's
much more in a liberated position to do what he wants without having to worry about Russia and China and having to worry about, you know, this kind of first world versus second world situation. So that might be a big impetus for him to change course, because there's no one who he has to answer to effectively. In a sense, Kim Jong-il and Kim Il-sung really did somewhat have to answer to Russia and China.
Well, we'll leave it there, just pending future events and maybe revisit this. Well, maybe, almost certainly revisit this. In the meantime, of course, people should be reading, to get the background they need, they should be reading Dear Reader, your book, shouldn't they?
Which is not a free ebook.
It is not. You got to pay for that, baby. I think you could even get, for a premium, you understand, a signed copy at michaelmalice.com. Can they do that?
Only for your listeners, Tom.
Oh, that's very sweet of you. Your site will know that they're coming from my show. So that's super. Also, the audiobook features, is it somebody we know who reads it?
No.
But it's read very well, you told me.
Oh, it was chilling for me. Because when you write in the third, when you write a biography or an autobiography in this case, I always hear the voice in my head. So to have that narrator have that voice be the voice I heard in my head was creepy and chilling. And the feedback I've gotten has been universally positive on the narration. It made me absolutely ecstatic.
Oh, that's great. Because a lot of times the narrators that the publisher assigns or that Audible uses are just meant to put you to sleep. And it would have been a shame for them to do that to your book. So it's good that you were able to pick out somebody who did a good job.
I almost couldn't believe it. It was chilling.
Well, you can actually get the audiobook version of Dear Reader for free. If you have not yet joined Audible, join it through tomwoodsaudio.com. And even if you, because they give you a free audiobook when you join, they give you a free book. And even if you quit, you decide, I don't want to have Audible anymore. If you quit in the first something like 30 days, you can still keep the book for free and Michael still gets his royalty. Everybody in the world is happy. I guess except Audible. But everybody else is happy. So check out tomwoodsaudio.com. Visit Michael at michaelmalice.com. Check him out when he's on Kennedy. Follow him on Twitter. Most important thing after you read the book is to follow him on Twitter because it helps Michael.
It's not family friendly, though.
It's not family friendly, but you know, and it helps Michael if you follow him, but it helps you more because you're depriving yourself of tremendous entertainment if you're not following him. And what else? How else would you follow him? At Michael Malice. You know, what other name do you expect? All right. Thanks, Michael, for the backgrounder. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom.
All right, everybody. That's going to do it. Thanks so much to all you good folks who suggested this topic in my Supporting Listeners group over at supportinglisteners.com. I certainly appreciate that. And I will see you all tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.